Okay, hagudavach. We are in Sha'ar Cheshbon HaNefesh, Perek Gimel, the ninth Cheshbon, Vahatshi'i. Vahatshi'i, Cheshbon HaAdam Im Nafshay, a person should be contemplating b'minei ma'aseh avoido v'hishtadlusoi bahem. Whenever you're involved in Hashem's service, to what extent are you putting in the effort, l'machlekoseihem, with all of their different subject divisions? Meaning, is avodas Hashem for you a business of, okay, just tell me the basics and I have to get on with life, or what do I have to do now? Tell me in a basic way, how can I be yotze? Or are you really approaching this with an intensity, with a passion? The Chazon Ish said, there are people who have 613 mitzvahs, and then there are people who have 613 problems that they need solutions for. Right. So, ki hishtadlusoi b'ma'asei malkoi. Does it compare to the way you would put an effort if you were doing things for a king? Now, the king of Mashal comes up all the time, and in our culture today, it's like doesn't speak to us much because, especially since I think everybody here is American, we don't have anybody English here. But even if we had someone English here, it's still not very far from what we're used to today. But we'll try to put it into a little bit, to put the idea into some more, bring it home a bit more. Let's just appreciate the fact that in the olden days, when you're talking about a king, it was not just a matter of, well, a king was a matter of life and death. There was a lot more to it. If you got a letter from the king before you opened the envelope, so there was a certain level of nervousness, obviously, but there's also a significant level of excitement and anticipation because a letter from a king can mean anything, and it can really mean something very, very life-changing. Like, for example, let's say you are a seamstress, okay? So the letter of the king might have nothing to do with that. It might be a summons for some crime or something, chas v'shalom. You might be facing a serious trial. But it might also mean that maybe the king wants you to prepare clothing for an upcoming royal banquet, which can mean that if you do the job well, maybe you'll be taken on as the court seamstress. Maybe you'll be the person with the contract for the all the royal house's clothing needs. That would put you into a totally different social bracket, and that would also make you from middle class to a very wealthy person. Continue doing the same tailoring, but you'd suddenly be a very, very wealthy person. This could be life-changing. Any letter from a king could be very life-changing. I was once saying this over, and somebody came over to me and told me that his aunt was actually the dressmaker for the English queen. So there's a whole there was all kinds of different rules and stuff involved and protocols and but he said that her whole life revolved around it, even though she wasn't busy with it on a daily basis. It was from time to time, but her whole life revolved around the consciousness of being the dressmaker of the English queen. Whatever the case is, this is the point that we're bringing out here. So let's say a person gets that letter from the king. You don't know. Am I in big trouble? Is this an unbelievable opportunity? Am I being brought into the royal court? So, and then you open the letter. And yes, the king wants to assign you, commission you to make an outfit for an upcoming event. How will you approach that assignment? If the king imposes on you some deed, if it's really just a matter of physical activity, let's say making that outfit, so you are going to put your all into it. You're not, if we want to put it into more American terms, let's say the Elon Musk, is that how you pronounce the guy's name?
Yeah.
I understand that this is a fellow who's not so poor. But he also, some specific business, a project, gives you So you're going to want to put every ounce of your energy into it because who knows what this could lead to. It could lead to really, really big things. So if you're doing that job for the king, you're not going to let, you're going to be putting all your energy into every last detail, and you're not going to leave anything undone. Now, if it's a matter of that requires more thought, let's say it's a matter of thought, it's not a matter of deed. Let's say the king wants you to plan something, okay, not just to what would, if there's a war, okay, and the king takes you or this person who's and says, I want you to, this guy is an officer in the army, and he says, now there's going to be a whole campaign going on over here. I want you to plan the campaign and lead it. This is not a matter of action. This is a matter of strategizing. This is a matter of planning. This is a matter of intense thought. So you're not going to just try to, I have a bunch of things on my mind. I'm going to try to figure out a general idea and let's see if we can implement it. No, you're going to clear your mind out. You'll just give me a moment. You're going to clear your mind out entirely and just focus all of your mental energies on not missing a tiny thing and getting this done right.
Here I am as a seamstress in my house, and I get this message on the call. This may be the job, so I'm really going to do it really well. But if he employs me, and it's day in and day out, every day, all day, after a while, you're not going to keep that standard up because
Good. Okay.
it's just too much to do it all the time. Like Rosh Hashanah, okay, but then
So apparently this is
it
Mamish the
gets.
natural question, because also when I gave this when I when I, when we were learning this in the men's chair, I got the same question. You're doing it day in, day out. But you know what? Let's go back to the Mashal of the King. Let's go back to the Mashal of the King, and then we'll answer the question in terms of the Nimshon, because this is an important point. In the Mashal of the King, let's say you have a person who did secure the job of the royal seamstress. And she's doing it day in, day out. Now, she is very keenly aware that at any given time, there are 15 top seamstresses who are waiting to take her place. Right? Now, which means that, yes, she will always be living with the understanding that she has to be up to her top performance because this is a very, very high profile job. And there isn't much room for error. And there are always top people who are ready to replace you.
But in life, are there top people ready to replace?
Oh, okay. First, I just want to work out the mashal. Great. Okay. So we could fathom a reality where a person is living with that constant sense of, as accustomed as I grow to it, as used to, as much as I become used to it, I have to keep up top level. It was interesting once we went when we met a when I was a bacher. I had a cousin who got married, and as a bacher, he had gotten involved. There was a big celebrity musician, very famous in the Haredi world, who had a struggling son. And my cousin, who was that type, he got involved with this boy and really, really put a lot of effort into him and got him to a very good place. So this singer came to perform to do his wedding, to do this my cousin's wedding. And then afterwards he joined the Sheva Brachos. So there was a bunch of Yeshiva Bachurim sitting at the same table with this guy, and a lot of schmoozing started. And it was interesting. He made a comment that made an impression, and this is also related to this point. He said, every time I'm at an event, I'm putting myself out there, as I have a reputation. Every time I'm at an event, there are hundreds of people watching me to see if reputation is true. So he said, I always have to be performing at top level. I think what happened was they asked him to sing something at the Sheva Brachos. The guys, he didn't want to because he wasn't prepared. And he said, I can't do that. So this is another bringing out that there is such a reality as no, you can't afford to allow yourself to settle into that day-to-day routine. So now the question is, how does that work with Hashem? With Hashem, it's not as simple. And you know what? Part of what we're trying to do here is, that's right, take something not simple and try to break it into us a little bit more. Meaning that understanding that if we can appreciate what the opportunity of serving Hashem is. It's true. We live in a physical world, physical bodies with physical capacities. It's hard to maintain that all the time. But the truth is, let's look at this last week's parsha. A malach had his once in history opportunity to actually stand and praise Hashem, right? The malach who was struggling with Yaakov. This is my chance. And he didn't want to miss his once in history opportunity. And therefore, he's begging Yaakov, let me go because this is my slot. This is my slot to praise Hashem. The malachim look at us as human beings. Human being is a very, very unique kind of bria. Because the opportunities that we're given are something that Malachim look at with unbelievable envy. They're pushing jealous. But at the same time, they look at us and they say, but these people don't appreciate it. They'd be out of their bodies and up in the upper worlds and seeing what every moment of opportunity is, they'd be head over heels. They'd be head over heels. But we're in our bodies and therefore we don't appreciate it. But the opportunities that Hashem is showering down on us are mind-boggling. It's just that, again, the body doesn't have the capacity to really be attuned to that. But this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to unnaturally drive it into us, into ourselves, to be able to appreciate that, yes, each moment of life is actually a once-in-history opportunity. Just what? We get another once-in-history opportunity, and another once-in-history opportunity, and another once-in-history opportunity.
I have another question. So if you're working for the king and you make a mistake, of course you're always frightened you're going to get sacked. You know, like that's the end of you, right? So, I mean, that's like what a lot of people use to try to induce performance for a chef, like.
Oh, so that's for sure. So we don't want to go in that direction, and that's why, on the contrary, the way we've been framing this mashal now, the way he's framing it here, is not necessarily from the angle of if you mess up with the king, you're dead, like in Parshas Miketz, which also reflected that reality, right? They let up a little bit on the job. Stone got into the role, right, and he hung. We're coming from the other end. We're coming from the angle of appreciating the opportunity. Appreciating the stakes in the positive sense, in the sense of what the opportunity to be able to perform for the king is and what sort of opportunities that can then open up for you. This is the way we're approaching this mashal now. You don't want to get into trouble with Hashem, and you have to be very conscious of that. But Hashem is not standing there. This is something to appreciate. Hashem is not standing there ready to zap us at whatever happens, right? At any small mess up. Hashem wants us to grow and to progress as human beings. And he wants us to reach the greatness of human beings. He doesn't expect us to be malachim. You can't sit complacently and just be okay with faults. You can't just let mistakes turn into a habit that Hashem will come back at you with. But you're meant to grow through error. You're meant to grow as a human being. Okay. So now, v'imbalishabchod, and if it was a matter of coming to actually praise the king, or if you're coming to thank the king for a chesed that he did for you, or chesed she'asa imoy. Now here also, let's appreciate that the issue here is not the fear of getting in trouble. The issue here is that if the king did for me something very special, and I want to write a letter of appreciation, or I want to come, I'm being granted an audience to express my appreciation. I want to get it right, both because of my appreciation of the immensity of the fact that he gave me that attention and the favor, but also because I want to maintain a certain standing with him. So this again, this is not necessarily about fear. It's about appreciating the awesomeness of the interaction and wanting to get it in the best way, wanting to get it perfect. To the extent as perfect as it could be. And therefore, you're not going to just write a letter, you know, pull out A4 paper, whatever, lined, you pull out a paper from your lined notebook and write, Dear King, thank you so much. All the best. You know, right? And that's it all. You're gonna spend time researching where you can get the best stationery and the fanciest envelope. And you probably won't write the letter yourself. You'll probably work very, very hard on the text and consult with copywriters and then hand it over to someone who will write it up in handwritten calligraphy.
That GPT.
Okay, there you go. That's the way to do it right. So the point is, let's try to look at the human example of where we would really be trying to make the best possible impression. And now try to apply that to Hashem. So kefizeh, I'm skipping a few lines. This is what we want to apply to Hashem. That any act that you do in Hashem's service, you know what, I want to bring this point home from another angle. This is actually, no, not next week's parsha. Okay, next week's parsha. Let's talk parsha for a minute, maybe a couple of minutes. Paro has a dream. There's going to be a famine in Mitzrayim for 7 years. There's going to be plenty for 7 years, and there's going to be a famine for 7 years. That's a very significant piece of information for a king who's responsible for the country. Yosef is the one interpreting it to him. And now Yosef comes up with a brilliant idea. How can we handle this? What are we supposed to do about this? There'll be 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of hunger. What idea could we possibly have? Now listen to something brilliant. Would anybody have thought of this idea? When there's a lot of food, store it away, and then you'll have it when there's no food. Mind-blowing, right? And how does Paro respond? Paro responds, "Ein novoin v'chacham kamoichem." Now, there's nobody as wise as you. Now, either this really reflects on Egyptian intellect, meaning there was nobody in Egypt who could come up with this idea. Okay, so yeah, bring in the Jew and make him the minister of economy. But come on, there has to be something more to it. Like, what was the unbelievable brilliance in Yosef's suggestion? Oh, so the interpretation of the dream, that's right. But Pari's responding to his Eitzah, right? Yosef didn't suffice with interpreting to the dream. He says, then he goes on and tells Pari, and here's what you should do. I have an idea for you. Put away food, and then you'll have it for the hungry years. So the truth is that no, there was more depth here, which Pari discerned. Anybody could think of that idea. That would obviously be the obtuse. Egyptian viceroy could have figured that out also. But what's the point? The point here is like this. When you're going through 7 years of plenty, there's so much. It's very, very hard to be in the mindset of course, you're going to be putting away tons of food. But if a few kernels of wheat drop on the ground here and there, it's going to be very hard for 7 years to be in the consciousness of, we can't let any kernel of wheat escape us. That when you're packing away a ton, okay, a ton, I mean, a whole, onto a big container, right? And a couple of kernels fall to the ground and roll into the corner, for 7 years to be saying, get those kernels. Don't let one get away, because when the years of hunger come, we're going to need every last one. That would be very, very difficult to maintain. For 7 years. There's just so much, and so we missed a few kernels. There's tons and tons coming. Paro saw in Yosef that he had that appreciation of, I mean, when the way Yosef said it wasn't just the idea, yeah, put away and he'll have. It was, we're not going to be able to miss a thing now. Every tiny thing. If someone finishes a piece of watermelon and chucks it on the side, we need somebody who's going to come and shave off the little bottom, layer that's left and dry it and put it away for the years of hunger. Okay, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but not much. So when Pari saw in Yosef the determination with which he said it, Pari understood this is a man who will be able to do that. And that's going to make a big difference. In the years of famine come, all those one kernel here and two kernels there are going to be the difference between life and death. So Pari said, that's the man we need. So let's appreciate that our existence in Olam Hazeh is essentially that, meaning we are surrounded by opportunity in Olam Hazeh. That's what the Medrash says, that a person who lives in Olam Hazeh is a wealthy person because there's millions growing around you all the time. It's just an issue of reaching out and plucking it. But because we're so surrounded by mitzvahs and opportunities, we can afford to let some go by. There's so much. There's a little thing here and a little thing there. What do I need this for? What do I need that for? But part of the idea is to appreciate, again, it comes back to this point of appreciating what the opportunity of life in this world is. And it's not so long. Bezos Hashem, we keep saying, all of us, Bezos Hashem, 150, not at least 150 years. I think I've said that a few times. Moshe Feinstein was opposed to saying 120 years. He said that there's no basis for that, and why limit it? So I think if we say at least, it's not a curse, right? It's not a curse. But 150 years is still a tiny sliver of time when you're talking about the billions of years ahead. When you're talking about the billions of years ahead. And the question is, it's about taking advantage of the opportunity and appreciating how valuable every moment of life is, and to be able to put things aside all the time, to be looking, what can I grab now? What can I grab now? But let's move back to our subject. The point that the Chovas HaLevavos is making is, if you appreciate what it means to be performing for Hashem, if you appreciate what it means that you have Hashem's attention, so you want to be operating no less than that person who's trying to make that impression on the king. And here he moves on to specify, and here we're going to get into some very profound things. This is a very classic little piece here. So now he says, "Vehu," and when we talk about approaching our performance with Hashem this way, what that means is "Shakol Ma'aseh Shehu LeElokim." Any, whenever we talk about doing something for Hashem, performing for Hashem, einenu nimlat meechad. Anything, anytime you'd be performing for Hashem will fall into one of three categories. What are the three categories? Echad mehem choves halvavos bilvad, meaning there are three types of mitzvahs that you might be doing for Hashem. One of them is what we call choves halvavos, the inner mitzvahs, mitzvahs that are totally an inside business. Which is essentially the subject of this sefer. For example, Avas Hashem, Yiras Hashem, Emunah, Bitachon, etc. These are totally inner activities. So that's category number one. And these are things that are ongoing all the time. Hachelek Hasheni. Category number two is mitzvahs that essentially involve both. There are mitzvahs that essentially require both the body and your inside. Kimai, such as tefillah, meaning as opposed to mitzvahs that are totally physical. Tracy's a whole list of them, right?
Yes.
Lulav. Right, that's right. Right, all the things that are totally physical. But these are mitzvahs that really require both, like tefillah. He's going to have a whole elaboration on this one. Tefillah involves action. You have to get up and say the words. But also, we understand that tefillah is mainly an inner business. Limud Torah, same thing, sitting and learning. You have to sit down with the sefer and you have to focus on certain material, but it's primarily a mental business. Okay. Hashevach v'teilo lelekim, or standing and praising Hashem. Now, this is something you're doing with your mouth. But obviously, the essence of it is the mind and the heart. The limud hachokhmah, v'tzavos batoiv, v'azhir min hara. And also to be instructing other people, to be teaching them about doing the right thing. This is an interesting thing. He's also saying here that it's a matter of the inner intent, just as much as it's a matter of the actual activity. Whatever it is, that's category number two. The mitzvahs that entail physical activity and the inside, your inside. Hachelek HaShlishi, and then category number three is just pure physical activities. Choves HaEvarim Bilvad. Things that are purely physical. Ein LaLev Bahem Shum Hachnasa. They are not essentially a matter of the heart. Meaning the only place your heart really has to be involved in order for the mitzvah to be fulfilled is that you're doing it as a mitzvah. And if a person sees something on the table, picks it up, oh, what's this? Not sure, he puts it down. And then someone says, oh, that was a lulav. Oh, that was a lulav? What's today's date? Oh, it's Sukkot. Oh, I just did the mitzvah. Then we say, no, you're not yotze if that's how you do a mitzvah. You have to know that you're doing a mitzvah. So that's the extent, but that's all. When you only need the consciousness and the intent, I want to do a mitzvah now. But other than that, it's a physical act. So now, do you mean? What's that?
Here, make it in Kaddish, you know.
That's another point, meaning the idea of doing maaseh mitzvahs just with your physical limbs is what's mekadesh the material of this world. But here he's talking about what does the mitzvah actually look like? Does it have to be an inner activity? Now, inner activity always enhances any mitzvah you do. But
But
here we're just talking about what is the, just to be yotze, to say, I did the mitzvah. Right? Just to be able to say, I did the mitzvah. All you need is the prior intent, and then you do the mitzvah. Right? A person who just picks up a lulav mindlessly, we're not going to say he didn't do the mitzvah. Right? He knows it's sukkahs, he wants to do the mitzvah. And he picks it up, but he's spaced out. We're not going to say he didn't do the mitzvah. Right? Could have done it in a more valuable way. But the mitzvah was accomplished with the physical activity, such as lulav, right? Sukkah, lulav, tzitzis, mezuzah, keeping Shabbos, mayadim, tzedakah, etc. Okay.
we do a mitzvah, let our mind move somewhere else, and then immediately after having done the mitzvah, let's say it's making a bracha, we realize, oops, we didn't have kavanah for the bracha. If we then have the kavanah, do we get, like, does it work
Can that count?
retroactively?
Can that count? So very interestingly, there is such a thing, which actually makes its way into halacha. Like, I'll just give you an example of that, is that this is, here we're talking real hardcore halacha. You have to be mechavan in the first bracha of Shemoneh Esrei. What does a person do if he realizes, so we say that really, essentially, according to essential halacha, if you weren't mechavan in the first bracha of Shemoneh Esrei, you have to daven again. Now, I mean, if he realized in Moedim that you didn't have kavana, you have to daven again. We don't rule that way. Meaning, the halacha lemaisa is, we say in today's generation, if you operate with that, you'll be spending all day davening. You'll have 16 Shemoneh Esreis a day. So we don't. We say that no, don't do it again. But the question becomes, what happens if at the end of the first bracha you suddenly realize that you didn't have kavana? So the Chazon Ish actually said, now think. Now think of the content of the first bracha. There are other examples. We find there is such a thing. There is such a thing of, oh, a minute, I chapped. And now I'm going back and putting in the thought. It's a big subject, actually. I'm going to resist getting pulled fully into it now, but it is a big subject. Yes, you can imbue things with meaning retroactively.
What if you make a bracha? You washed for. I washed. I wanted to wash for Nitzavus Tibayim, and I washed for Nitzavus Tibayim, and they made the bracha Asher Yatzar because you make it so much more than you do for bread. What do you do?
Right.
It's
If
the
you
first
made the wrong
non
bracha,
bracha of
if you made the wrong bracha.
but you did the Netilas Yadayim on the right with the right kavana that you were going to do. You did it twice,
Right.
not three times, but you made the bracha.
Right.
Okay.
So then we would say after that, you just make the correct bracha after that, and you say Baruch Shem about the wrong one, and Hashem will say, I credit you with the fact that you say Asher Yotzer so often. That's what came out, right? So, but yeah, you say Baruch Shem. I know, I had a nephew who, not a nephew, a cousin, who was always taught, you're not allowed to say your parents' name. And he also was taught, you're not allowed to say Hashem's name. One time he said his parents' name by mistake, and he right to say, Baruch Shem, void malchus le'olam. Okay.
I've been here on the davening thing they did. They were saying they have this like Shabbaton on davening. Like you're halfway through the Shemoneh Esrei and you realize you just sort of plowed through the middle, up to the middle, and you weren't really concentrating. And he said it was like you're holding a basket of apples, and like some got loose. Now, you could spend your time concentrating on the ones that fell on the ground, meaning spend your mental command, oh, I forgot the dove and I wasn't really with it. Or you could just concentrate on the apples you still have in your basket and just really put your kavana in the remaining
That's
brachas
right.
that are left, which I thought was really good because
That's right.
if you spend your time going back to the beginning and thinking, did I really have kavana, then
Oh,
you
okay.
don't have kavana for the end because your mind is at the beginning again.
Right. So let's just make say there. It could be that what I just said now might have created a little bit of confusion. What I said now is about right after the bracha, realize that before you move on, you just go back and you think about that bracha. But no, we didn't mean to say, oh, well, I'm not getting married now, but come to think of it, Mincha and Shachris, I didn't really have kavanah for. And that becomes your focus for the whole Ma'ariv, right? No, there we would definitely say that's the Chafetz Chaim's apple mussel. That's right. Grab whatever apples you can get. That's right. But what I was saying in a much more specific way, you just finished something, you didn't chap at the time. This is something that applies to many areas of Ruchnius. Go back and do it now. But you know what? I'll tell you, Rabbi Victor Miller said this about other areas also. For example, he said, simply gave. Well, he said about Mila. Okay. Most babies are opposed to the idea and
What
opposed to
opposed to
the
the
idea.
idea?
Okay. We're talking about a bris Mila. But you know what? No one's asking them. And they don't even, the truth is, they don't even really realize what's happening. But whatever the case is, it's an interesting thing. You're talking about one of the greatest and most sublime mitzvahs that a person does, so anywhere from oblivious to preferring not. Yeah,
Protesting.
right. So isn't that something of a shame? So, but Victor Miller said, you know what? If that suddenly occurs to you at the age of 37, so what you say to yourself is, oh, woman, I had a Mila. It was a long time ago already. But you know what? Now I'm going to think back and say, you know what? I'm happy I have a bris. I would want that. At this point, I would say, even if they have to hold me down. And you're actually imbuing meaning. You're imbuing more meaning into it retroactively. This is relevant for other such things. Let's say he spoke about, he said that he went to Slabodka. Very interesting the way he framed it. But Avigdor Miller famously was a Talmid of Slabodka. But interestingly, people don't necessarily realize he went there at a pretty relatively advanced stage. He was about 24 when he went there. He already had smicha. He was already an accomplished, learned man. But he said Slabodka was where he really just, that was the turning point of his life, just moved him into a whole new place. And he basically, you know, that's where his spiritual life started, even though he was quite a conscientious, okay. Now, apparently, I didn't totally understand this, but he kind of attributed it to social pressure, meaning a lot of his friends were going. There was pressure to go, and it was almost like he said he's not going because I already, you know, I'm on my way toward becoming a teacher, and why do I need to go start learning again? But there was pressure, et cetera. He ended up going, and that was just put him into a whole different place. Okay, the example of Slabodka profile was his legacy. So he said the same thing about that. He said, at the time, I went because of social pressure. He said, but now I think back today and I say, yes, I want it. I want it. I want it. So there's such a thing. Yes, there is such a thing as imbuing value, but right, not in a way of letting it distract you from all the rest of your life and just going back and focusing on 1 minute. How many brachas did I say yesterday? Let's see if I can make them all up. Okay. Fine. So let's just tie things up because Umamish almost in mid-sentence, we'll just set it up for next week, and that is that the Chavos HaVav is about to show us what it's supposed to look when we say put all of your energies, your physical energies, your emotional energies, your mental energies into your performance for Hashem. Don't just do it in a lackadaisical, whatever kind of way. And we broke it into three parts. There are the mitzvahs that are primarily physical. There are mitzvahs that are physical along with the inside activity, tefillah, learning Torah. And then there are the mitzvahs that are just internal activity. the Ava, the Yira, it's Emuna, etc. And we'll have to see how to apply this to these three. We'll see in Mitzvah Shem the next week. It's a very, very classic piece where this is where he really dives into the whole subject of tefillah. Let's
Important.
see.
They're an important level of one over the other. Those categories.
It's hard to say that there's importance. I would say it a little differently. The lave part is what determines the value of the other parts. But that deserves more elaboration. Bli Nedar, that'll be part of the discussion next week.
Yes.
Continue.